Hello and welcome to another NBC Pro Basketball Talk podcast. We're going to be breaking down the NBA draft and the trades, the handful of trades rather than the massive plethora of trades we expected. Today joining me, I've got Dan Feldman from Pro Basketball Talk. How's it going, Dan?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. And also joining us, as always, is Dominic Ridgard from NBC Sports. How's it going, Dom?
Great, Kurt. How you doing, man? I hope you guys are able to rest up a little bit after a late draft night.
We got in a little sleep. At least I did.
I got a couple accidental hours.
Yeah. Yeah, I stayed up late, but I overslept this morning to make up for it. So let's start at the top of the draft if we're going to talk about the draft. And I had Minnesota among my winners because they didn't overthink this. They didn't screw up the obvious. They took Karl Anthony Towns, and then they make a nice little trade later, picking up Jones. But, Dan, your thoughts? I mean, we're going to start at the top. They've got to be seen as a winner. They got the best player in the draft.
Yeah, I mean, they were positioned to win last night as soon as they won the lottery, and as long as they didn't do anything stupid. And, and not only did they not do anything stupid, they made the best pick. Towns is probably the best talent available, but he's also just a really versatile player, so it gives them the freedom to grow in a number of different directions, whatever opportunities come up. And I like Tyus Jones as a nice piece, a steady point guard who can really help them take advantage of all the talent they're accumulating.
Yeah, you know, like you guys said, it's when you have the top pick in the draft and there's a consensus no-miss guy like Towns, you know, it's served up for you on a platter, and I think the guy's going to fit great in Minnesota. I think his skill set will absolutely translate to the NBA quick and right off the bat. You're going to see him make an immediate impact. I like the moves. I also like the moves that they made, shifting some picks around, picking up a guy like Tyus Jones, like you guys both said, back up to the incumbent Ricky Rubio. But, you know, that guy's had so many ankle and issue problems that they need a guy that they feel like can at least grow in that role, and a guy with a high ceiling, you know, a guy that they think can grow and develop and do a little more from distributing and shooting the ball as well.
All right, well, we've got that one. The draft really starts to get interesting at number two. For weeks, the Lakers had been throwing smoke out there, apparently. They've been telling myself and everybody that it was Jahlil Okafor. He was their guy. That's where they were leaning. And then in the last 24 hours, it became pretty clear they liked the D'Angelo Russell better. And Mitch Kupchak said on LA radio on Friday morning, "Now we decided about a week and a half ago, we really liked Russell better." They may have lied to everybody, but it worked for them. You know, I like this. Look, I like the pick. I think it really comes down to how you grade out Russell versus Okafor and where you want to put them in. If you've got those two on the same level in today's NBA, I don't really have a huge problem with taking him as number two and going with the guard over the big. Dan?
Well, I also have them on the same level. So to me, it comes down to team fit and maybe some other small things here and there. I guess I would have leaned toward Okafor very slightly, only because there's so many good point guards in the league right now. You know, I think you can find one not too difficultly. To get somebody like Okafor, this is pretty much your one chance. And maybe you don't need to take that chance. You don't necessarily need a player like Okafor, but increasingly you need a player like Russell, and the Lakers got one and one of the better versions of those types of players.
Yeah, Kurt, you know, it's the first I'm hearing that you said that Kupchak said they tabbed Russell as, I guess, the better prospect than the guy for them a week and a half ago. That means, you know, even it's one of those things where it's like the lying by omission. You know, like, even though they don't have to come out and say they see all these rumors flying around, like, oh, no, we're not that high on Jahlil Okafor. They just kind of let the rumors stew, or they let the consensus stew. They say, okay, let everybody think we're going to take Okafor. That's fine. You know, we've got the guy that we want to pick. And, you know, I really like Jahlil Okafor's skill set as a scorer in the post. And I think that, you know, it's how much of a move for the future is this in terms of, you know, eventually the ball is going to have to be in somebody else's hands beside Kobe Bryant's. It might not be that first year, or maybe Kobe's willing to acquiesce and play off the ball a little more. But I thought, we'll see. I thought, you know, for immediately going into next year, you know, kind of thinking, I guess, maybe even too short-sighted, like Okafor would be a good fit because he doesn't really, he doesn't need the ball for that long in the shot clock to be effective, and he can pass well out of the post. But I'll echo what you said, Kurt, and a lot of people were saying, you know, in today's NBA, it kind of starts from the backcourt and moves forward. A lot of people were saying, well, the Lakers are old school. You know, that's not how they think. Even in a derogatory way, they're saying they're too old school. They're not hip to the new NBA, so that's why they think they're going to take Okafor. And they pulled a complete 180 and surprised everybody.
Yeah, they certainly surprised Sam Hinkie and a few of the teams behind them, at least in the last 24 hours, like I said. And I didn't mind their other pickups. If you talk about the guys farther down the draft, they get Larry Nance Jr., who, yeah, he tweeted some stuff, whatever, when he was a college freshman. I don't think we should be held accountable for the mistakes we made as college freshmen, or I'd still be in jail somewhere probably.
Yeah, seriously. I'm glad you brought that up, because, like, that it made me so upset when I saw that and the Bobby Portis thing, because I'm like, come on, we're going to retroactively bring back these tweets from 4 years ago? Like, this needs to stop. This is gotcha Twitter journalism that's just – it's just kind of – I get why they do it, because it makes for a funny or interesting Sports Center segment, and everybody can't wait for that first interaction between Nance Jr. and Kobe. I'm sure that's going to be a hell of a conversation. But it's like you said, these are tweets from 4 years ago, people. Like, we need to stop this. It was the same thing with Draymond's tweets about LeBron like 4 or 5 years ago. It's kind of, I think it's reaching its boiling point where it's kind of unnecessary.
Well, I think it's really good fun. For like the Bobby Portis one, or even Damian Lillard with LeBron, like, you know, these guys were kids, and they probably weren't really thinking realistically about the NBA, or if they were, they definitely weren't thinking about the consequences of how it would play out. I don't want to like be too much into this, but it might be different with Kobe. I mean, he's a very serious guy. He doesn't strike me as someone who's going to take this in the fun way.
No. You know,
and especially the content of what it is, but about anything, even for any joking tweet. I mean, I'm from Flint, and there's still stories about Corey Hightower, not making the Lakers because he refused to do the typical rookie hazing of carrying Kobe's bag. And I don't know whether that's true or rumor, but it's believable because that's how Kobe is.
Yeah, and like you said, I think the content here is a little different than some of the other stuff. This wasn't, oh, he's overrated or something. He went to Colorado, and that's a really touchy subject.
Yeah, that's a huge shot. That's not something. That's not just, oh, you suck. It's the content of that is way drastically different.
So that will be an interesting first meeting. But look, you can get past it with Kobe if you show up and work hard and say, hey, I was a freshman, I've matured. We'll see. So let's move on to the next pick, which, look, I like what the Sixers did here. I get it. They've got Joel Embiid. They've got Nerlens Noel. They've got Sarge coming. You take the best player on the board at this point, and the best player on the board was Jahlil Okafor. Get too much talent at one position, and you can sort it out via trade way easier than trying to take lesser talent. So, I think that this is a good pick, and I think it means that somebody like Noel or Embiid is going to be on the block at some point down the line.
I think you're absolutely right, especially on the part that it's easier to trade than to try and win with a lesser talent. I mean, really, the way the league is going, as centers are falling out of favor, maybe the 76ers are just going to have all of the good ones, and there's really going to be a scarcity, and teams are going to have to trade with them.
Right.
I think what's interesting about Philadelphia's rebuild that differs them from other teams, obviously the one is the extreme they've taken it to, but other teams have gone down this path or have committed themselves to go down this path for a certain amount of time. But Philadelphia, what they're doing is they're saying, you know what, we're organically going to determine when the right time is to try to be good. If they could have gotten D'Angelo Russell this year, I think they would have taken him. I think that would have sped up their timeline a lot, and I don't think they would have tried to kick the can down the road. But now I don't think they really have much choice but to be patient, and this is probably going to push them back a year or so of when they're going to be good, because it takes time to get these guys, to get their values up, to trade them, to find the right fit. So it's still going to be a long-term process, maybe even a little longer, but I think that's the best thing for them if they continue that patience.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I think at least I was very convinced that you know, that the order of 1, 2, 3, I thought this wouldn't get interesting until 4, but like we've been saying, it got interesting right away at 2. And as soon as the Lakers took Russell, like, wasn't expecting it. So my first thought was, wow, I think Philly's kind of, they're not back to the drawing board, but they realized that the guy that they, I think they would have preferred Russell over Okafor, but now that they have to shift their mindset back to, okay, who's our top rated player? And you guys are right. At that point, it was Okafor, and they had to make that pick. I think what kind of set the criticism off wasn't just that pick, but it was, like we've been saying, the picks that followed. You know, the picks of five guys who were like 6'10" and up. It made that pick in concert. Like, okay, what are you guys trying to do? Like, this is starting to get ridiculous. You know, even Joel Embiid, the king of Twitter, had to come out of hiding and laugh a little bit. Like, okay, so what? There's eight guys trying to take my spot now. It's just, you know. I've been a little critical of what the Sixers are doing, because I agree with you guys in terms of, like, you know, they're building assets and they're kind of building towards the future. And Sam Hinkie even came out and said, you know, you can only really start building a team once you have cornerstone pieces. But before you have, if you don't have those, you know, you're really in no man's land. So they're just trying to get the assets to get to that point. But it's like, how far can you kick that can down the road, like you said, Dan, before people start to get upset and want to see a team at least try to win? You know, I guess the one saving grace is that they didn't take Porzingis, because then it would really be 3 or 4 years down the line instead of just a couple.
Well, when teams shortchange that process, when they commit to it and start to go down that road and just get impatient, they really set themselves back by being patient and waiting for the right moment. The 76ers are going to have the highest ceiling possible. That's not guaranteed to win a championship, but I think that's their best course.
Definitely. It's just,
and again, you're talking about guys down the line like Rashawn Holmes and some of the other guys they picked who are big, some of the Europeans. Some of those guys are going to be stashed. Galidas out of Lithuania, or however you pronounce that. I get it, and I think what you do is you hope that some of those second rounders pan out. I mean, that's what the second rounders is about at this point. Outside, once you get past the first 5-7 picks, usually, you're just rolling the dice on guys and say, maybe this can pan out. Maybe, you know, we'll take a shot at this guy, which is, you know, I'm surprised some of the guys who didn't, like, nobody took a shot on Upshaw or some of these guys, because that's, to me, vintage second round picks. Maybe some of these guys pan out. And if you get if you end up with an extra good shooting stretch four, there's a market for it. And as Dan was mentioning earlier, there are plenty of good point guards out there. And you're going to be able to trade for one. There's going to be one on the market pretty much always. So I think this is a move, like Dan said, I agree. It probably sets them back a little in terms of timeline, but not so dramatically that it's that big a deal, you know. Plus, don't know where Embiid is at this point.
When do you even get to showcase?
Are we going to have him this year?
When do you even get to showcase the assets that you have, though? You know, like, when you look at all the people they took in this draft, the only one that at least that jumps out to me that has any real value is Okafor. And then what? So are you going to try and flip Embiid or Noel for that backcourt player you're talking about, or you wait till next year and try and flip one of your high picks again? I think one of the big things that came out in this draft for me, and, you know, it speaks to, you know, trying to trade these picks for better players, is that the asking price for these high picks, if you want to move them, has to come down at some point, because there's plenty of speculation in sources saying that, you know, a lot of teams tried to get back into the lottery. A lot of teams tried to move up, but the asking prices were just too high. And if you're gonna keep driving those asking prices up, you're just going to keep selecting guys that, you know, either you don't think are franchise players or are going to be hard to trade.
Exactly. Well, let's move on then to the pick that made Knicks fans cry.
Literally.
Literally, actually, at the arena. It was one of the best videos, one of the great moments of the draft, was the reaction when the Knicks took Kristaps Porzingis at number 4. I will say that this is my general thought on this. For how long now have we been just hammering the Knicks? Oh, why do they keep taking shortcuts? Why are they shortcutting the process? Why are they looking for the quick fix? They're not. This is not the quick fix. They did the opposite of this. The question is now, can they actually develop a guy? I mean, I don't know if they've got that in them, and I don't know if New York can be patient to actually do this.
Well, I think we've seen that Knicks fans can't be patient. I mean, they melted down last night in a way I just can't understand. They got somebody who's a very good value, and I think they a normal franchise, I would call it an excellent pick. I have the same questions as you. Will the Knicks be able to develop them? Will they be patient? And I don't know. They haven't shown it, but I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt and say there's a new person in charge in Phil Jackson, and there's going to be a new way of doing things. And they deserve a chance to show that they can or can't develop somebody.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The reaction was so overwhelmingly negative from the Knicks fans that were there and, like, the different talking heads that it's almost – you've almost seen a reversal where, like, there's a lot of defenders now out there saying, like, hey, like, let's chill out. This is actually, like, a pretty good pick. Like you guys were saying, this kid has upside and there's pretty good value there. It's funny how that works. It's like the collective outrage can kind of – can almost set the narrative in an opposite way, because now you're seeing, oh, this is the right move. This is a build for the future. This is – you know, a kid with a lot of upside. This is a young piece that we need to cultivate. Whereas, you know, before the draft, I know you and I were saying, Kurt, like, they need someone that could help right away. But now, now I think it's a shift in mindset. But the tough thing for Knicks fans to swallow now is that their two most notable moves since Phil Jackson was hired don't jive with one another. You just gave a 31-year-old, quote-unquote, superstar a 5-year max deal. And he's coming off a knee surgery now, and then now you're drafting a guy whose consensus is he's 2 or 3 years away. The two, even though the two moves could be considered the right moves, they just don't mesh with one another.
And there are reports now that today Carmelo Anthony was called up Tim Hardaway and expressed displeasure both with Tim Hardaway being traded away as part of another move by the Knicks, and this draft pick, and I've got to wait around for this guy, and it's exactly that. If you're bringing back Carmelo, you're kind of saying win now, but to me, this is the dichotomy of the Knicks for so long. Phil Jackson gets that it's a process, and we'll see if he actually sticks around for this process, but right. He gets that it's a process. On the flip side, there's James Dolan, and you know the Carmelo Anthony contract started there. By the way, Phil, you get the job, but you don't have a choice on Carmelo. You're giving him a max.
Yeah, he has to stay here. No, you're right. And I don't know. It's a difficult position to put your president of basketball operations in, but it's also his job. You know, his job's not supposed to be easy because that's why he's getting paid, you know, the X amount of millions of dollars that he is. He has to work to figure it out. And it's not to say that the two can't coexist. And it's not to say, you know, all the projections are is that Porzingis is going to need all this time. Like, you know, if all the potential can bubble to the surface, if there's signs that this kid at least has it, you know what I mean? You can usually tell pretty early on if the guy's ceiling really is as high as people say he is, or you can get that, like, oh, no, feeling. Like, we might have messed up, you know what I'm saying? So if he can at least show flashes that he was worth that high of a pick, then I think it'll kind of quell the storm a little bit.
I agree. I think that matters in terms of the Knicks fan base. And I think, look, we'll say this about the Knicks fan base. They're generally pretty smart about basketball. They're not the Laker fan base. There are smart Laker fans out there. There are, but the Knicks fans in general kind of get it, and I think you're right. If they see hope there, if they see flashes, they see look, the guy's going to come in and can shoot the ball, and if he can do some things early, then you go from there. We move on to Orlando. Dan Hezonja, they pick another quality young guy who's going to play on their wing, but hard not to like this pick. Hard not to like this core. I think they've got a lot of nice players there without a star, without an elite night, the A-list guy, the alpha. But Hezonja is going to be another quality piece.
Yeah, I'm with you. They're starting to put some stuff together. I don't think all those players are necessarily destined to become nice starters, but if they're so deep with solid prospects that some of them are going to turn out. It should put them on a pretty good path, especially if they get good coaching from Scott Skiles or their next coach as they figure this out. They're a young team. They're going to be developing for a little while. Hezonja, I wasn't quite as high on as a lot of other players. He's obviously very confident. You can hear that in the way he talks. You can see that in the way he plays. And especially on the court, that comes with some negatives. It comes with a lot of positives, and I think people spend a lot of time talking about those. He's not afraid to take the shot. He's not afraid to do anything. But sometimes he's not afraid to make a pass he shouldn't make or dribble into traffic that he should avoid or gamble defensively when he shouldn't. So I think he has a lot of work to do, but there's definitely raw talent.
Yeah, Dan, you know, I like the pick, too. What it shows to me, at least, is that, you know, they're starting to build a team. Like, there's a semblance of a team. It's not necessarily they're just collecting assets like some of the other rebuilding squads in the NBA, you know. You have their point guard that they like in Elfrid Payton. You have the shooting guard that they like, and who's blossoming into a really good player in Victor Oladipo. Now I think Hezonja slides into that small forward spot, floor spacer spot, where he can pick his chances when he wants to kind of pop to the outside and be a floor spacer or a guy that can catch and drive, you know. And then they've got the Vucevic, who's shown to be a great stats guy. Now, can he be a winning player on a winning team? But that's what I like most about the pick, is that they're assembling a team. They're just not collecting assets, which is refreshing to see for any team in the lottery, because it feels like, you know, the top five, that's all it's about at this point.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how Hezonja and Oladipo play together, play off each other. I mean, there's going to be some adjustment there, but there's no reason it can't work. And it, you know, especially if Hezonja can defend really well, and they can defend a three with that, as the league goes smaller, it's almost a three guard lineup, but that's not a bad thing. All right, we'll move on now to number six, the Sacramento Kings, who do not believe in floor spacing inside, apparently. They have gone with Willie Cauley-Stein to play next to DeMarcus Cousins. This is going to make them a very interesting defensive team inside, but I'm not sure. Look, I'm going to pack the paint on them right now offensively. So, Dan, what do you think? I don't love the pick. I don't hate it, but I don't love it.
Well, I don't really like the pick, and that doesn't have as much to do with the fit issue. I just don't think Willie Cauley-Stein is good enough to go that high. He obviously has great defensive potential. He can guard every position. You know, you can do some very interesting things with him. But the way people talk about him, they act like it's a given he's going to be an all-defensive team player, a defensive player of the year. And I just don't think that's the case. I mean, he very well could be. I would not be surprised one bit if he is. But he's not a lock to be that level of a defender in the NBA. And without that lock, you know, there's questions about his rebounding. His offense is very raw. There's questions about his injuries. There's questions about how much he loves basketball. And maybe some of those are overblown, but I think between all of them, I think that was a bit of a reach.
Yeah, and it's funny because I know the guys on the on the broadcast hit this a lot, but the fundamental shift in what you ask from a big man now, because of the success of guys like Tyson Chandler and DeAndre Jordan, who both aren't that offensively gifted, but if you can set a good screen, roll to the basket with some kind of force and finish above the rim, like, there's a place for you in the NBA, like, and a starting one too. Like, that's a very coveted skill set. But like you guys said, to just assume that he'd be on the same level as these guys and pick him at six is a big leap. You know, we don't know if he's going to be anywhere near as good as those two guys, even though, you know, he has the same skill set. But what is that? He's athletic and can jump. You know, that's not something that you sink the sixth overall pick into. And I'm pretty sure, I can't remember if it was Vlade or someone in the Kings organization said, well, we see Rudy Gay playing a lot of four this year. So it's like, okay, so then is Willie Cauley-Stein going to be on the bench? Or is he going to be a starter in name, and then you just platoon him whenever Boogie needs some minutes, assuming that he's on the team, of course, which, you know, that whether that's true or not is neither here nor there right now. I guess that's up to if the Kings owner is willing to kind of let things play out. But, I mean, I agree with you guys. I think it was a stretch. I think third to last, they were 28th or tied 27th in opponents' points per game last year, and they didn't do a good job defending around the rim. So clearly that was a need for them. But how well he fits into the overall scheme of their team, you know, that's yet to be determined.
Yeah, and the other thing we haven't discussed, the other reason he was mentioned as sliding down a lot of boards, possibly to late lottery, was simply there's concerns about his foot, which was surgically repaired a year ago. Like, we played all of last year at Kentucky, but there are concerns that the way the screws are in there, where the pins are in there, are going to require another foot surgery, which could keep him on the sidelines for a while. And big men with foot injuries are a scary thing anyway. But I think you can get past that if you really believe in the guy. Look, does George Karl believe in the guy? Does he like him? Because that may be the issue. I mean, that seems to be the issue with all the bigs now.
Maybe the bigger issue is George Karl going to be the coach in a week, or 2 weeks, in 2 months?
Yeah. I don't, you know, I heard that they're not planning to fire him right now. But, man, I'm telling you, are you really going to let Boogie and Karl go to camp together and have Boogie start pulling power plays? This is a whole nother podcast, but that has a lot of potential for mess.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the things that kind of went under the radar for me, or something I didn't even think of, is if they get rid of George Karl, you're enabling your temperamental star player, basically saying, you know, the team is yours and we're willing to make all of our major decisions around you, which really isn't all that smart, especially with a guy, you know, with DeMarcus Cousins' kind of behavioral history. But it's like the rubber has to meet the road at some point. Either these two guys got to learn to get along, or you know, someone's got to acquiesce. Maybe they both just kind of swallow their dislike for one another and keep it moving. But, you know, you don't want to bank on that heading into a season when you've said you want to win because you have a new arena opening. Like, that's just not smart.
Well, just the one thing I'll say relative to the pick is whether or not Karl and Boogie can eventually get along, or whether they can get along right now, or what it would take, I do think that at this point, firing Karl has to be something the Kings have on the table. Whether they go through it, how far down their list of options it is, you know, I don't know. But considering that, you know, only a few months in the job, that's already, I think, what should be an option for them, there's no way I'm considering how a player fits in his system when drafting.
That's a valid point. And so we will move on to the number 7 pick. We're going to go through at least the first top 10 here and talk about some of the other plays, but Emmanuel Mudiay, who a lot of Knicks fans thought was their guy, had fallen all the way to 7 with the Nuggets in a by Ty Lawson pick.
Yeah.
It's been nice knowing you. They snatched him up, and Ty Lawson got that, by the way. He and his, I'm sure, legally tobacco-filled hookah.
Yeah, right.
were caught on video saying it's, he's off to Sacramento, which is a whole... Let's not even go down that road again. That's back to the George Karl road. But I like this. This is a team trying to really reshape its culture, really reshape its locker room. I think that video of Ty Lawson shows you why they think they need some different people in that locker room and some different leaders in that locker room.
Yeah.
And Mudiay is an incredibly talented guy who is one of those guys who could be one of the more talented. You know, in 5 years, we're looking back like, how did you look past this guy? Look at all those physical gifts, and he brought them together. I don't know if that's going to happen, but he has the potential for that.
He does. I thought he was the best value on the board. He's not a great shooter, which is a little bit concerning for a point guard, especially the direction the league is going right now. But he's strong, he's steady, he's a good passer, he has good vision. There are a lot of ingredients to work with, and you can hope his jump shot comes around and improves. I think his value, and regardless of fit or what it means for Lawson or anything else, I just think he's the most valuable player on the board. Like we were talking about before, you take that guy and you figure out the rest later.
Exactly. You know, he must have been the highest rated on their board. He's a guy, you know, it's a slide to 7, you know, that's almost like a backwards compliment that, you know, you still go top 7 and you consider it a slide, but I like the pick. I think the guy is aggressive. I think he'll get up and down the court quick. You saw that Denver often tries to take advantage of the altitude that they play with, and he's a guy that I think is going to be one of those energetic, up and down the court, really. I think he's really going to display how athletically ready he is for the NBA. I think his body is there. It's like you guys are saying. It's if he can fix the jump shot, if he can at least get it to a consistent level where he's at least a danger on the perimeter shooting, I think he's going to be a great player.
Plus, look, he spent a year in China, and yeah, he was injured for a lot of that, and his game matured or what. That is a growth personality-wise, human being-wise type of experience, even more than going away to SMU and playing for Larry Brown for a year. You've got to deal with such culture changes, such food changes, such lifestyle changes to be in a place like China, where it was an incredible dropout rate for American players and European players because of the culture shift, that he fought through this, stayed with them, played pretty well by the end of the year. But I think it's a good maturing process for a locker room that might need some maturing again.
Yeah, you know, I think it's kind of, when we talk about, you know, whether these guys decide to go to college and the debate on whether they're paid or whether they're not paid or yada, yada, yada. And then people just say, well, if they want to get paid, just go to China. It's like, do you understand what you're saying? You're asking this 18-year-old to leave his family and go across the world to China where he doesn't know anybody there. He might not speak the language. He doesn't eat the food. And like you said, he survived and thrived there. You know, he fought through the foot injury. He put up respectable numbers. He showed enough tape that shows you that he could play in the NBA. Like you said, I think that's a valuable experience. I know Ed Isaacson was on the pod, on Wednesday, and he said, you know, maybe going to school might have helped his game a little more. But, you know, just growth as a person, like you said, I don't think you get that kind of professional experience until you learn to play for money, until you learn to make it your job. And he did that. You know, he has a step ahead on the other guys in his class.
He does. Let us move on. And Dan, this is going to be up your alley, your hometown Pistons. And if there was one expected pick, I think, in the top eight, it was top 10. Stanley Johnson to the Pistons was pretty much on every board, and it came down and it went that way. They need a three. I think this is a solid pick for them. Dan?
Yeah. I predicted Stanley Johnson to the Pistons also. It was a real shock that Justice Winslow fell that far, and he was there, and he's sort of a better version of Stanley Johnson. So I was really glad to see that the Pistons showed the flexibility to adjust their plan and draft Stanley and draft Justice Winslow. Oh, no, they didn't. I don't really get this pick. I think Stanley Johnson and Justice Winslow are very similar players, very stylistically the same, play the same position. I can do similar things as far as being defensive first wings with some growing shooting ability, but definitely areas that both still need work. I just think Winslow's a better version of that player. I find it hard to argue, though not impossible. I like Johnson too, but I find it hard to argue that Johnson is better than Winslow.
No, I agree, and I think the other concern with Johnson versus Winslow is simply a jump shooter. I mean, Winslow shot 41% from three, and while there's questions about his ability to sustain that and how consistent his jumper is really going to be, if you're playing in a Stan Van Gundy offense, especially with Andre Drummond in the paint, you want some guys who can space the floor. You've got to be able to do that a little bit, and I'm not sure. Johnson's got some work to do. I'm not saying he can't get there, but I think Winslow, like you said, is simply farther along on that curve.
I actually think Johnson is a slightly better shooter at this point. Just if you look at maybe some of the nature of those three-pointers, I know his percentage was a little lower, but the nature of some of those and his free-throw percentage, I think, is indicative of how he'll shoot in the NBA. So I actually think Johnson's slightly ahead in shooting, but it's only slightly, and it doesn't change my overall picture. And how quickly Justice Winslow has improved as a shooter, because that was a huge knock on him when he got to Duke, gives me some encouragement that maybe his growth curve could be faster than Johnson's going forward.
Exactly. So we move on to the Hornets at number 9, and there was a real sense after Noah Vonleh got shipped out the day before that Frank Kaminsky was pretty much bound for Charlotte. They were going to take a shooter. I think it was always going to be him or Booker. They went with Kaminsky, the heart of the Wisconsin team, I should say, that went to the championship game and upset Kentucky. This is a solid pick, maybe not without some of the upside, especially considering, again, Winslow was on the board. But I don't hate the pick. It's. I think Kaminsky's going to be a rock-solid NBA pro.
You know, Kurt, I will say this, though. I think it is a little risky. You know, first off, what you heard the words a lot. Michael Jordan loved Kaminsky, and that kind of made everybody go, oh, no. Yeah. his history with picking in the draft isn't that great. But I feel like
he falls in love with guys during the tournament.
Yeah, right? I guess that's what it is. But I feel like we've seen the Hornets / Bobcats take three guys in three consecutive years that were supposed to kind of do the same thing in Cody Zeller, Noah Vonleh, and now Frank Kaminsky. Cody Zeller a little less because he didn't kind of have the potential shooting that some scouts saw, but definitely with Vonleh and Kaminsky. And my worry with Kaminsky is that he'll be overwhelmed a little bit athletically, you know. And I go back to the Cody Zeller thing. And whenever I watched him play, it always just looked like things were moving a little too fast for him. Like, he kind of knew what he wanted to do, but he couldn't get there quick enough to kind of have any real advantage over anybody on the offensive end. And then defensively, you know, I think he's going to be a liability. I don't think he's a bad pick, because I think he will provide offensive value right away. He's a guy that can shoot the ball. But I'm just a little worried that he might have been overdrafted at 9, especially with a guy who I was high on, who I'm sure we'll get to next in Justice Winslow.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think he's a fine enough value at 9 in a vacuum, but when Winslow's there, I think you need to show a little bit more flexibility. And I know you just traded for Nicholas Batum, but again, and I know we keep hitting on this, but take the best player available and figure it out later. Nicholas Batum only has 1 year left on his contract. He's coming off a really horrendous year. It's hard to really explain why that happened. There's no locks about that. Don't pass on Justice Winslow if you think he's the best player, and obviously the Hornets didn't have to feel that way. I don't know how much they drafted for versus best overall, but everybody else seems to believe Justice Winslow is the best player. Take him and figure it out later. Don't pass on him because of Nicholas Batum.
Exactly. And, you know, I think the Warriors proved that you can never have enough wing depth, especially guys between, like, the 6'6", 6'8", area. Being able to switch, you know, both, like you mentioned, Batum, both Winslow and Batum kind of the stalwart of their game is defense. So, you know, I think even if you feel a little – I guess my point is you should never feel too crowded on the wings, you know, especially with guys who can switch on pick and rolls and guys who have upside shooting the ball as well. So I agree with you. I think, like you said, we don't know their draft board. We don't know how high they had Kaminsky over Winslow or vice versa. But it seemed like he was the best player there. And if the fact that Nick Batum is already slated as your starting small forward is what deters you, then you drafted incorrectly. You didn't draft in the best interest of your team.
No, and that moves us on to Winslow, who I think we can all agree fell to a great spot for him. Like, he came down the board and down the board and down the board, and now he's in a system in Miami that's going to fit his style of play. And it's a reason I had Miami as one of the winners of the draft. I think that this – Pat Riley had to be doing a little dance that this – I'm not sure I want to actually picture that, but he had to be very happy that Winslow fell to him.
Winslow is a great fit with Miami, both for talent and how he fits with the other players there. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more perfect pick. And what I really wonder now is what the Heat want to happen with Luol Deng, who has a player option. I think it's worth about $10 million. I think Luol Deng will definitely be better than Justice Winslow next year and probably even the year after. Yeah. But is Winslow close enough when he's on that rookie scale salary that maybe the Heat hope Luol Deng opts out, and if they can re-sign him, great, but if it gets too expensive, that's money that can go towards these difficult situations with Dwayne Wade and Goran Dragic and get that all cleared up. And yes, you downgrade a little bit small forward, but you're keeping the rest of your team together.
Yeah, and I think you hit it on the head in terms of, you know, if they get in the situation where they can't re-sign Deng and they have to let him walk, you know, what was kind of constraining them or what was big in the news was, you know, are they gonna lowball Dwayne Wade, or is their offer gonna be too low for Goran Dragic? Like, that could help sign that. That could help help answer that question. But secondly, you know, I watched when I watched the Heat, it did feel like, you know, Luol Deng isn't a young pup anymore. You know, he's a very good player, don't get me wrong, but he's starting to get up there in age, and like we've mentioned before, when you play for Tibbs, you play in dog years, kind of. Your legs are a little more worn down than the average guy who's 10 years deep in the NBA. I watched him play, and he was, and I know when you get traded midseason, it's tough, but or when you're with a new team, it's tough, but he didn't look like the same guy. He looks like he's running a little slower and he's a little less explosive. He's still, his shooting numbers were still okay. They weren't great. But I don't think the drop off is that heavy with the guy with the upside of Winslow, and I actually think that if Winslow's defense is everything that we saw in college, and if it can translate to the pros, I think he even provides a little more versatility in that he has quicker foot speed now to deal with some of the quicker guards in the NBA.
Yeah, definitely. I think this works out in a lot of ways for Miami, and you're right about Deng. He's not the long term answer for them either way, and now they've got a long term answer. And honestly, I look at that Miami Heat roster, whatever happens with Deng, and think, yeah, they're going to do. I don't know how deep they're going to go in a playoff run because of their style, but I think they're going to win a chunk of games next year if they can stay healthy. I think that they are a team that's going to climb up pretty high into the Eastern Conference hierarchy. I don't think they challenge Cleveland for a title come the playoffs, but they're going to put up some wins.
Especially in a weak Eastern Conference, you know, I think it's easy to lose sight of, Miami was struggling, but they had a midseason acquisition that kind of shook up their team when you bring in a new starting point guard. And, you know, the best player, the guy they signed to a max deal, he had to deal with a serious injury, and that's a huge blow to a team that was really banking on him for a lot of production. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities that they go top three, top four next year in the East. I think that's very possible.
Let's talk about two other teams and two other moves. The one other really interesting move, the one team that was considered a reach, was the Boston Celtics at 13, if you remember. A lot of people were surprised, 16, that they took Terry Rozier out of Louisville, a point guard. A guy who can score, but a guy who has some pretty big holes in his game, and it was a little odd to see that when you consider guys they might have used, like Rashard Vaughn, like Sam Decker, even like Grant out of Notre Dame, if you're going to draft a point guard, who are still on the board.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the worst picks of the first round. I think they made up for it on the back end, taking R.J. Hunter at 28.
Yes.
I thought he was one of the best picks of the first round. If you had swapped those two, I'd call that pretty good, although even at 28, that was a little high for me personally. On Rozier, he can get to the basket. He's athletic. He dribbles well. He gets there. But then what? He doesn't pass really well. He doesn't draw fouls.
He's not a great
finisher. Like, it's a great start. And if the Celtics see that they can work with that and develop him past that stage, like, there's something to work with there. So if they're convinced, okay, I get it. I'm personally not convinced. He's already 21. That's not ancient or anything. But compared to some of these other prospects, he's a little farther along. Age-wise, I'd like to see him further along developmental-wise.
Yeah, and, you know, the backcourt is pretty crowded over there in Boston because they just drafted Marcus Smart, who were they already dangling in trades. They re-signed Avery Bradley. They drafted James Young, trade for Isaiah Thomas, and now you take another two guards. It's definitely a little bit head-scratching. I do think that, you know, there are a lot of reports coming out now that they were trying – pretty hard to move up into the top 10, especially I think the reports were they were trying to get to number 9 from Charlotte because they wanted to draft Justice Winslow, and they were trying to kind of package their picks, and I think they put a lot of effort into that, and then once they realized that fell through, I think they kind of fell back on the, okay, who is our highest rated player, and kind of no matter where that falls, we're going to take them. You know, whether Terry Rozier should have been that high on their board is up for debate, but I think it's obvious that's the guy that they were highest on, regardless of position. And, you know, like we mentioned before in the pod, are you taking players to build a team, or are you taking players for assets? And that's kind of where it gets murky, because as a person looking at the Celtics roster, you just kind of left scratching your head, like, where's the direction? What are they trying to accomplish?
Yeah, it's definitely asset building mode, and I just think there might have been better assets for them to have picked up at that point, yeah. Is the problem. And there was one other interesting move. It's the trade. There were a handful of trades, but only one really interesting one, I think, or one really big with some names. Portland sends Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and what's left of Steve Blake to the Nets, and get Mason Plumlee and Pat Connaughton, a sharpshooter out of Notre Dame, out of it. I don't mind that trade from a Portland standpoint. I'm not as high on Hollis Jefferson as some, but it's another sign in the it was nice knowing you, LaMarcus Aldridge. Good luck in with your next team.
Well, I'll do you one better. I like it for Portland. Whether or not Aldridge comes back, obviously it's a little more meaningful if he's gone. But I think Mason Plumlee was the best player in that trade. I think Plumlee, Damian Lillard pick and rolls are going to be awesome. And even if Aldridge comes back, they can work with that. They can work with him and Vonleh, especially Vonleh. You know, I don't know how ready he is to play yet. I really liked him in the draft last year, and one of the reasons is because he's so young. So I'm willing to be patient with him. I think it's a red flag that the team that knew him best, the Hornets, were willing to trade him. But given the way the Hornets have operated, that's not a deal breaker. So I think they're strengthening their young crop, whether they need to rebuild right now or whether these are just reinforcements behind Aldridge.
Yeah, Kurt, and, you know, I really agree with you in terms of this may be kind of another sign that LaMarcus Aldridge is leaving. I think they want – if he does, I think they're going to go very guard-centric. I think they're going to build their team, obviously, around Damian Lillard and the flashes that we saw from C.J. McCollum against the Grizzlies in the playoffs. So I think they're going to want bigs that are going to be able to run up and down the court that can roll to the basket hard and pick and rolls. And I think – like Dan said, Plumlee was the best player in the trade. So, you know, that's kind of the litmus test for if you won or lost that trade, is that, you know, you have the best asset that came out of it.
Exactly. A couple other quick things let's hit on. From the Justice Winslow, I can't believe he fell that far to a great spot for him fit. There is Bobby Portis out of Arkansas, somebody that Ed Isaac said our draft expert was really high on and a lot of other guys were. He fell all the way to 22 at the Bulls. And finally, the Chicago Bulls draft a high-energy, defensive-minded, physical, will-not-quit kind of guy that's perfect for Tom Thibodeau. but I even with Hoiberg there, I like this for them. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's a good pick by the Bulls for sure. For Portis, we'll see. They have a very crowded big man rotation with Joakim Noah, Taj Gibson, Pau Gasol, Nikola Mirotic. It might be hard for him to crack into the rotation, and I'm sure he would have liked to go higher and made a little more money. But for the Bulls, yeah, this is great. They're working from a position of strength now, and I think they were already going to have to look to trade one of those guys just to make sure they stay clear of the luxury tax to re-sign Jimmy Butler. Now it's even easier.
Yeah, you know, I like the versatility that he brings. I think he's a big guy that has a solid offensive game. I definitely think, you know, the Chicago writers and reporters on Twitter were trying to quell the notion that this is insurance for in the case of losing Taj Gibson. But I think that's definitely a real possibility, is that they want to take this guy because they want another energy kind of hustle on the offensive and defensive side of the floor type of big that could come in and spell Noah or Gasol. And it wouldn't shock me, you know, like you said, it's getting too crowded. One of those guys has to go. It's probably Gibson, and I think they thought that. And again, when you're a team like Chicago, sometimes you have to draft off need. I think they got fortunate that it's need and best player that was available.
Yeah, it worked out really well for them. And sometimes fortune smiles on you in the draft. Speaking of teams you liked the moves, Dom, when we were talking earlier, you liked what the Rockets did picking up Decker and some of the moves they made. Why don't you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I thought Sam Decker, you know, he was one of the guys whose draft stock was kind of booing, going up and down. You know, you heard him as high as a lottery guy, then you heard him down into the 20s. I think he fell to the perfect team in Houston. You know, the strength that he has is that he can get out and run a little bit. He's pretty athletic, and he can shoot the ball. I think it just fits perfectly in what Houston wants to do. They want to get up and down the court. They want floor spacers. They need guys who can now catch and take it off the dribble and make decisions. You know, we saw in the playoffs, there was just too much playmaking responsibility on Harden. Like, he's amazing, but you need to take some of that away, even just a little bit, just to kind of throw different looks and kind of reserve how much energy he expels on a given night. I thought, and you know, he was a first round pick, but the expectations on what he'll be able to do for Houston aren't too high. You know, you have the alpha dog in Harden, you have the second best player on the team in Howard, you've got guys like Trevor Ariza and Patrick Beverley who are the solid NBA vets. He's the rook that's going to come in, you know, he's going to, and they ask him to fill a role.
hit some timely shots. Get out and run when you get minutes. You know, I really like that pick. And a guy like they took in the second round, Montrezl Harrell, who fell pretty far considering where his stock was. Just a hustle guy that I think is going to, again, he's going to run up and down the court. He's a little undersized, which is kind of he's kind of fitting into that undersized role of big man for the Rockets. It kind of feels like they're collecting them, but he's a guy that's going to get up and down the court. He's not going to take a lot of shots because his jump shot's a little broken, but he can finish at the rim. I think they both fit perfectly with the Rockets.
Yeah, and by the way, with somebody like Harrell, I love if you can get an energy-like guy like that in the second round and not be necessarily. So occasionally, they've got the talent. If somebody like a Portis, you've got the talent to be committed to them in the first round. But I think those are great second-round picks where you're not as financially committed to them long-term. But those are the kind of guys coaches will tell you, look, it's fun to have that guy in the game. The fans love him. I mean, I remember going to Summer League many, many moons ago. And my wife came with me to actually watch one of the games because the Lakers were playing. She was curious to see. And I don't even remember who the number one pick was that year. Everybody fell in love with Roni Turioff because it's Summer League and he's literally diving over the first row of seats to save a ball because that's the kind of player he was. And fans love those kind of guys. If you can get him in the second round, that's a quality pick. You know, that's a guy that's great in practice, too, because he pushes your guys in and he'll keep going like that. All right, well, thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm glad we got to cover the draft here. Next week, we're going to get into more free agency. How many teams will DeAndre Jordan want to meet with, and why is he meeting with the Bucks? And then we'll get even more into the Kings and everything. So, and we'll be back. Thanks again. Dan, thanks for being here. Tell everybody where they can find you on Twitter.
I'm at Dan Felton.
All right, perfect. And Dom, thanks again as always. We will see you next week. And people on Twitter can find you at?
At DL Riddy on Twitter.
All right, cool. Thanks a lot, everybody, and we will talk to you next week.